The following is the first part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
This morning we're going to start a series on what I call paradigm, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, paradigm spirituality, which was a term that was popularized by Thomas Kuhn in a book that came out in 1962 called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he talked about the idea of a paradigm shift, which has become very popular. But before that time, people really didn't know about what that meant. And basically, a paradigm is a way of seeing or a way of looking that will affect your view of the world. It's based on implicit or explicit rules that shape your perspective. And so we're going to be looking at, I was going to call this perspectival spirituality. It just didn't sound good, you know, it just didn't perspective and all. But really what we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks is the fundamental biblical theme of the temporal versus the eternal. Two conflicting perspectives. And I'm convinced that it's a huge, huge category in Scripture. In fact, my conviction that Jesus spoke more about the temporal versus the eternal than any other topic. We often hear that he spoke more about money than any other topic, but actually, when he spoke about money, it was in the context of the temporal versus the eternal. That was his whole point, was to say, what's going to last, what will endure? And so we want to be people who prize and treasure what God says is going to last. So I want to think about this in just in terms of general insights here, that we're going to be looking at two value systems then, two value systems, and we're going to emphasize the need for a shift, a paradigm shift from a cultural way of seeing life to a biblical way of seeing life. And I'm going to emphasize that we're constantly under stress and pressure to buckle down and cave into a cultural view of life. It's just because it's so ambient, it's so present, it's so constant, inviting us to see things from this present darkness rather than from God's perspective. And we're going to be saying this, well, that the experience of our mortality, a growing awareness of our mortality on this earth, can actually be used by God to help us transfer our hope from the seen to the unseen. It can actually cause you to transfer your hope from what is visible to what is invisible. At the same time, I believe it can also cause you to realize the preciousness of present opportunities. So that if you embrace a biblical perspective, you will move toward wisdom. The wisdom of embracing the present opportunities because they are fleeting, and to contextualize them into an understanding of eternity. So let's take a look at this idea, and I want to start off with the concept of a person who is given 1 year to live. You're given 1 year to live. What happens is you have some kind of a routine physical examination, and you're told by your doctor that you actually have an illness which is not palpable, not manifest to you, but actually will be terminal, and you've got about a year or less to live. You go to two other physicians and they confirm the same thing. There won't be any real obvious effects until the disease has accomplished its purpose and it reaches its course. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is if you really had this scenario, that is to say, you knew you had less than 1 year to live, maybe about a year. Ask yourself these three thoughts, these three questions. And number one, how would it affect your vision of life? That's the first thing. How would it affect your view or vision of life? Secondly, how would this affect your view of your roles on earth? Your roles as a friend, a husband, a son, whatever those roles might be, a father. How would it affect your roles, your vision of your roles in this world? And third, how would it affect the way you invest your remaining time? How would it affect the ways in which you invest your remaining time? Because clearly, such an understanding, a realization that we have little time, would or could have such an impact. And so my point is going to be this, that the degree to which it would alter your present perspective and practice is the degree to which your current view of life and the biblical view of life diverge. That is to say, The distance between your current view of life and the biblical view of life is the degree to which you would have, that this realization, this announcement would have changed your whole perspective and your practice on the world. Because indeed, your vision of life ought to be the same whether you have one day to live or 30 years to live. Your vision of life shouldn't be changed at all. Life has a particular purpose and point. Secondly, your roles in the earth, how would it change that? If you are living in such a way that you regard relationships and treat people so that it could be the last time you'll ever see them, should that change? And then the third thing that I'd have to ask you is how you invest your remaining time. And what I'm saying here is that if there has to be a radical adjustment, you have to ask yourself why that would be. Why would it be that we'd need to do that when in fact we have to say, what are we doing now? And is it God's will and purpose for us to do that? If it is God's will and purpose, why would we change it? So those are issues that we have to stress because, frankly, we don't know that we have a year. We can't presume on the future. We can't control one day. And so it would be prudent, really, to live in such a way that we treasure the opportunities of the present time, that we enhance the roles that we play and by serving other people, and that we also invest our time wisely and well. That we regard our service to people in our lives as our service to Christ. So that as we serve people, it's really your way of serving Jesus. And I'd like to say as well that the temporal perspective typically denies the imminence of death. The temporal perspective typically denies the imminence, I-M-M-I-N-E-N-C-E, not eminence, but imminence of death. What I mean by that is that death could occur at any time, and a temporal perspective causes us to live as if we will live forever. We don't want to think about that. We don't want to deal with that. It's an assault to our perspective, and because it's really an acknowledgement of our loss of control and the brevity of our life then. So the question will be then, how do we invest our most precious time, our most precious asset, which is time, in a way that'll have lasting consequences? That's really what we're asking. How can you invest your remaining sojourn on this planet in such a way that it will have an optimal impact, lasting consequences, on the lives of other people? So the temporal value system will deny, the cultural value system will deny the reality of death, and it will treat the temporal as though it were the eternal. The only time when people really who are seeking to avoid God are really confronted with the reality of their mortality, with the reality of the short brevity of life is when we go to funerals. That is to say, a funeral is in fact a window of reality. And therefore, people are often vulnerable at funerals, more so than they are at other times. Why? Because it causes them to question their own mortality. And there's a vulnerability for a while until about 3 days or 4 days later, we've marshaled our defenses and it's all over again. You know, it's a very short window indeed. And you get on with life as usual. And that's why I find it to be rather striking that we fail to see what's right in front of us. And we have incredible mechanisms then that cause us to really avoid the things that really are critical in our lives.
I like the way we dress up cadavers to make them look like they're real.
Well, we do. We dress up cadavers and make them comfy. We put them in these little cushioned little things as if they're it's going to matter to them. Will it matter really what kind of, whether they have silk in there, a nice little pillow? You put them in a little suit, you know, and tie them up and fix them up. Heck, I used to do autopsies. One of my many jobs was a clinical lab technician. I've had over 30 jobs. As a clinical lab technician, after a while, I got pretty quick with doing the blood analysis and the urine analysis, and so I managed to do the day's work in the morning, so it meant that I'd have the afternoons free. So what I'd do is hang around with the bacteriologist and also with the pathologist. This was at Rockland State Hospital, which was a mental institution. Sadly, it was the place where they filmed the movie Snake Pit, which is a gruesome film. I was not in that. No, that was before my time. But because snake bit was about shock therapy and all that stuff. As a clinical lab technician, then, I had an opportunity to kind of meet with all these people. And so the pathologist asked me if I'd like to assist him with autopsies. And I said, sure, but man, I was terrified going there the first time. Because, you know, I didn't know what to expect, and it was really kind of, I had to distance myself and so forth. You know the bizarre thing? After about 20 or 30 of these, I just walk right in there, I might have a sandwich. I mean, it just didn't, you know, it was a terrible thing. It's amazing how you became crass. Although, here's what I had to do. I had to make a distance between that body and the person. I knew that that body was not the person. That helped me a lot. But one of the things I'd do is after we'd do the autopsy, I'd sew them up. And with the men, you know, you just do a straight stitch. With the women, you do a Y stitch because they might have a dress on, you see. So you couldn't do a stitch up to here. You'd have to do a stitch that went from this way and that way. There's not a digression here. The reason why we are not digressing is because it all relates to the way in which we then dress each other up. Then I'd sometimes talk with the fellow who would come put the fluid in them, so he would embalm them and was watch them do that, so that they would decay slower. And then sometimes in the mortuary, I've seen how they dress them up and so forth. To be frank with you, whenever I've seen an open casket funeral, I would have rather it be closed casket. You know why? Because I want to remember them as they were. Not that waxy-looking figure that's in this box. And I want to say that we are terrified of death. That's why if you go to a funeral home, they won't talk about death, will they? The word death will not be used. They'll talk about the departed. They'll talk about any number of things. And we have a lot of euphemisms in a culture that seeks to avoid it. And I'm simply saying this because, you found the verse? Ecclesiastes 7. He says, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. So what he means is this. If you want to be realistic, a house of mourning is more realistic than a house of feasting, because a house of feasting, we distract ourselves from what is obviously around us. So it's a strange culture, then, in which we seek to avoid what is obvious before us. There is something in the Mahabharata where the question is asked, what is the greatest wonder? And it turns out that the greatest wonder is that people die around us all the time and we act as if we were going to live forever. That's the greatest wonder. And it's true. We always think that's something that'll happen to another person, but never really relate it to ourselves. Some of you know that I've had a lot of near-death encounters, a lot of near brushes. I don't know why so many, in a variety of contexts. Some of them were so serious that I was absolutely sure it was the last. And so I would actually, you know, what do they tell you have when you go through this? Flashbacks, you remember your life? I did. And each time it happened, I said, I'm not ready yet. Something got to be done. There's more. And so God would somehow pull me out of there. Whatever the situation was, whether it was a physical thing or a disease or an accident or near drownings, things of that sort. And somehow he'd give me more time, and I realized then I'm on borrowed time. Frankly, we all are. We're all on borrowed time. Every breath you draw, every beat of your heart is really something that God gives you. You don't control your time on the planet. It's just a realistic assessment. In Isaac Watts' hymn, O God, Our Help in Ages Past, a wonderful hymn, he actually writes the first stanza, and it's based upon an allusion to Psalm 90. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream, dies at the opening day. The busy tribes of flesh and blood with all their cares and fears are carried downward like a flood and lost in following years. At first that sounds rather depressing when you look at that. And I have a comment to make about that. What he's really meditating on, Isaac Watts, in that verse is Moses' observation about the radical difference between the eternality of God and the brevity of our own earthly sojourn. At the beginning of the psalm, he says, Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. But then he says, you turn man back into dust and say, return, O children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or like a watch in the night. You've swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning, they're like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward evening, it fades and withers away. This is also very reminiscent. And by the way, what does he say, therefore, to gain wisdom? What would we do? What would we be prudent to do in this psalm? Verse 12 is the key. So teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. A very important insight. I know I've shared this with you. I had a Hebrew prof who took this to heart. Figured as for man, his days are 70 years, or if due to strength, 80. But he says, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. He said, suppose I were given 70 years. How many days would I have left from today? And then he calculated that. And then what he'd do in his calendar, every time he turned the page in his calendar, he'd write that number one day less. So we'd just be, now that sounds rather morbid, but that's what's called, the ancients called it a memento morti. Memento morti means a reminder of your death. It's like the Ash Wednesday service when they give you the sign of the cross on your forehead and with the ashes. And what do they say? Remember that dust thou art and to dust thou wilt return. So what that is a reminder. In other words, seize the day. Use your time wisely and well, because the time on this earth is very brief. Someone else did this where he had some kind of little marbles, and he had a jar of marbles, and what he'd do there is he'd remove one. Again, each marble represented a day. He'd remove one each day based upon a 70-year. So once he hit 70 years, you're in borrowed time. Now you can put the marbles back and see how many extras you've got beyond what you might have expected. You see my point? The idea here is that, but all of our years are very short. The difference between 10 years of life on this planet and 100 years in light of eternity is nothing at all. It's nothing. It all flies away. So we see it as well in Psalm 39, verses 4 through 7, where David prays, Lord, make me know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Lord, you've made my days as handbreadths and my lifetime as nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. Is that ever realistic or what? The psalmist, you know, things haven't changed much. We're dealing with something now that's 3,000 years old. But the wisdom still is there. If we do not know why we amass wealth, if we do not know what life is about, we walk around as moving phantoms relative to eternity. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 6 through 8 also uses a metaphor similar to the one we saw in Psalm 90 to again develop the radical contrast between the temporal and the eternal. All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. And then James adds the same kind of sobering thought. He says, you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow, he says in 4:14. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Why do you suppose there are so many texts, and there are others that we could multiply, that invite us to recognize our mortality and the fleeting nature of our earthly sojourn? Why do you suppose that is? Is it to make us depressed? You know, it's necessary.
I think the Lord knew we would live in denial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Denials of, you know, rationalization and posing as indifferent are really big factors in our lives. Yeah, we long for eternal life, and it's difficult for us. The problem is, like Dylan said in one of his songs, don't go mistaking paradise for that home across the road. And what he's saying here is you do not want to confused now with then. God has wired you for a longing for eternity, does he not? And what the mistake we're making is to suppose that eternal realm is here. And what we want to do is treat earth as if it were heaven. Frankly, people knew better in earlier days when life was more tough than it is for us. Frankly, we are among all the people who have ever lived on the planet, the most affluent and comfortable people who have ever lived. We are. And I mean just as the whole world. Now within this world, we here in our context in this world are the most comfortable. I've often told you that really relative to the way people lived, say, two centuries ago, you have more pleasures than kings ever knew. You live better than a king because you can control your climate perfectly. And you can go from point A to point B with greater comfort than a king could have. And you can command all the great orchestras of the world to play whatever you want at any moment. And that you can, and you have a variety of foods they never even dreamt about, options and opportunities that no king ever even conceived of. You see my point here. We live with great wealth and great affluence and great comfort. And consequently, we are basically the first generations of men who can now actually believe that we are now at home, that we are really in paradise, that this is heaven. And that is a terrible mistake, because when we do that, we live in illusion. Let me tell you a couple of thoughts here along these lines. I think the scriptures drive these images home to remind us that our stay on this planet is briefer than most of us would be inclined to think. And that may seem to be pessimistic and a morbid way of looking at human life. But I believe that actually, upon further analysis, this is the most realistic and hopeful approach you can have. I'm going to describe why is it realistic, but why, we already have a pretty good idea of that, but why is it hopeful? And I'm going to stress that it really is hopeful, because it relates to the human desires and aspiration. I don't know about you, but the older you get, the faster the years seem to whiz by. And furthermore, I can see all the decades of my life almost simultaneously. It's rather odd. My experience, I don't know if it's like yours, is that, let's say if I had a memory when I was 10 years old, when I can think of a memory at 20, and you can think of that, 30, some of you aren't that old yet, 40, 50, 60, wherever you are in your own journey, think of each decade, think of every 5 years, and you'd be able to think of memories, wouldn't you? 25, 35, 45, or whatever you are, however you are in life. You know, the odd thing is, the memories I have of things that happened last month are no more vivid than the memories I had of something that happened 30 years ago. Is that true for you? No more vivid. Why is that? I can still see myself at the age of 19 at the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity house talking with a couple of my buddies and saying, hey guys, we're at the prime. It'll all be downhill from here. And we actually made a covenant. We said, let's remember this moment. And visualize that, because 30 years from now, we will remember this. And darned if I don't remember it. I can see where we were standing by the stairs and where we had that realization of, even then at 19, how fleeting it would be. And we were right. I remember that. It could have happened yesterday with the clarity that I have. Now, that's an odd thing, by the way, and I will go on a short digression, but it's a very short one. He's my digression monitor here. What's interesting about this is, as I look back at my life, in a way, in your life, you can see your life almost as a seamless whole, can't you? Because it's an identity that's been shaped by experience, and you have this self that is the continuity of these experiences that takes them on. The odd thing is, then, you can look at time not as a succession of events, but as a complete unified whole. Do you see what I'm saying there? Because you can see your whole life in a glance. Am I making sense? You can see your whole life at a glance. I feel like I'm looking at a still life here. Which, by the way, is a hint of the way God views of all things. Because for him, there is no passing of time. He sees all things in a present glance. But we see a little bit of that in our own experiences as the years go by. Let me tell you why, first of all, that's realistic. This understanding of these images we've just looked at in Scripture are realistic because I believe it's better to know things as they are than to believe things as they seem. It's better to know things as they are than to believe things as they seem. The culture invites us to believe things as they seem. The scriptures invite us to know things as they are. And therein lies a great difference. The culture would seduce you into believing things that it presents you as if they were true. It is not. And the siren call of a culture will constantly give us these illusions that you have to go for the gusto and this is where it's going to take place and so forth. It does not require divine revelation to realize, and I've given you the statistic many times, but as George Bernard Shaw put it, the statistics on death are impressive. One out of one dies. And they are impressive. The only two people who ever escaped death, and you know who they were. Enoch and Elijah. Those are the only two people who never died. Everyone else on the planet has died. I love what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, though I tell you a mystery, we will not all sleep. That's the mystery, because the mystery is not all of us will die. When those who are alive when Christ returns will never see death, but they will be transformed instantly from a mortal body to a resurrected body. That's why I pray, Maranatha, O Lord, come. It'd be a nice thought for that to happen for us. I mean, it'd be a great way to go out of here with great panache, like Elijah. You're out of here. But our few decades on earth of life on earth last no longer than the flower of a field in relationship to the generations that come and go. It's the pathos of a beautiful flower. And Karen's garden is marvelous to see. It's at one of its peaks right now. But even now, I see the petals of her rose bushes falling on the, a lot of them are over the garage now, and they kind of meet together in these beautiful blooms. But already, there's all these pink petals on the driveway. And again, you realize how brief, how ephemeral, how short. In fact, every day I go on a garden walk, I don't enjoy doing the work. I enjoy the results of the work. And what I do is I take a slow kind of a prayer journey through that because I'm stunned by the beauty and diversity in the created order. And every day something's different. Something is got maybe a little bit gone, another new thing comes up to replace it. But the point is that is really a metaphor for the earth, for their earthly sojourn. Flower of the field. It comes as no surprise to realize that this biblical perspective is realistic. But how can you say that it is hopeful? How can you say that this view, instead of being morbid, is actually hopeful? That's what I want you to think about. Your thoughts on that?
Christ's promises.
What's that?
Christ's promises to me.
Christ's promises? Okay. Any other thoughts on this? I'll unpack that for you a little bit, since you're not unpacking it for me. A cow looking at a what? A new fence or a deer in the headlights. I've never heard the cow looking at the new gate, yeah. It's a new metaphor. I believe it's hopeful for the following reason. This perspective informs us that there's more to life than what we presently see. That's what it tells you. There's a great deal more to life than what we presently see. And I believe a biblical perspective assures us that our longing for more than this world can offer isn't simply a dream. It is a reality. The biblical vision, then, of God's invitation to us is not just forgiveness. That's only part of the bargain. What else does what does that forgiveness mean? It means that his life can now be in us. And therefore, it's newness of life in Christ. This is eternal life that they believe in you and in Jesus Christ whom you have sent. Eternal life, then, is not just endless life, but a new quality of life that is ours now. So that what I'm saying is that we have a new quality of relational life that will never fade or perish. And that's why I often put it this way. We are not defined by our past if we are followers of Jesus. What are we defined by? You're defined by your unbounded future. Your future, your past is going to be bounded and very, very brief. All the past you'll have on this earth will only be a few decades. But your future, on the other hand, is boundless. You are defined by an open future that'll go on and on, where every chapter will be better than the one before, and there'll be an infinite and ongoing, unchanging, a continual changing process, rather, a process in which we see new, have new insights and so forth, relationships. It's going to be not static, but a dynamic process. And so if I understand then that I have this glorious destiny, that'll contextualize my present tense, will it not? Just as if you read a Shakespearean comedy, you wouldn't know really it was a comedy until the way it ends. You see, because to be frank with you, the way things work often to, at the very end of a comedy, in the last act, it's only only in the last act and at the last part of the last act that all these that these tangled webs and these threads get somehow sorted out and all is made well. You know it's a tragedy when everyone dies at the end, like Hamlet. That's the, but if somehow they not only survive but thrive at the very end, then you know that the end determines the characters, not the past. Yeah.
To prove that I read your Oxford dissertation, isn't that the real difference between Freud, you're defined by your past, your psychoanalysis, and digging into it,
yeah. See, you did read that. I'm impressed. The Oxford thesis, and Freud would say that's all you've got is your past, and it's deterministic. It'd be a very mechanistic view that all we are is just mechanisms that are defined by our nature and our nurture, and we are very brief. And basically, it's a naturalistic philosophy is what it is, whereas a biblical philosophy tells us that there's an unbounded future. You know, I often tell people this, that, and I know we've talked about this before, but a lot of men we know are driven by future prospects, and they live from product to product. And so they feel that when they have achieved this or gotten that or accomplished this, that's when they'll either be happy or when they'll have enough time to do X, Y, and Z, whatever it may be. Then what often happens is you finally get to the end of the journey where it's nothing but memories behind you and you don't have much time in front of you. And then a lot of people do this bizarre thing. They make a sudden shift. Instead of living in the future, what do? Suddenly they go back to Nostalgiaville and they live in the past. It's a strange thing, which means it's possible for people to go through their whole life never living in the now. Never living in the present tense, never enjoying all that we have, which is the gift of the precious present. The precious present is really what we have been given, and that is a gift. And we must basically take all that we can out of each day and relish it, but also live in the now. All you have is the present tense, so that when we have a lunch meeting with someone, don't live with the thoughts of what you're going to do later that afternoon. Don't already be thinking about that. Focus on that moment. That's all you've ever got, really. The afternoon, those things will take care of itself. So those are just some thoughts along these lines. In my view, then, the biblical vision of God's invitation to us is not only forgiveness, but also newness of life. And consequently, He has given us a transcendent hope. And that this hope tells us that there's something in us that longs for eternity. Let me close with Ecclesiastes chapter 3.
So the future's nothing but the present that ain't got here yet. So live
in the future's nothing but the present and ain't. Sounds like something that could have been a causeism.
But he said the future is the present that ain't got here yet. So live in the present.
Live in the present.
That's all you got.
Yeah, because the future is not yet and the past is gone. All you ever have is the now. And we're not talking about not planning. I don't mean that. I just mean, though, not to live in the future. Because my problem here is that a lot of us suppose that the future will make up for our present lack. That's a serious mistake. The future will not make up for your present lack. If you're not content with what you have, you won't be content with what you want. And that will be a very real reality. We must not sacrifice the opportunities of today on the altar of future prospects. That's a terrible mistake to make. Many people sacrifice the opportunities of the now. Behold, now is the day of salvation. And they sacrifice them on the altar of future prospects, always saying, mañana, I can always put that off. I can always find time for that later on. And thus the years whiz by. In Ecclesiastes 3, we have this well-known text about there's a time and a season for everything. Made popular by Bob Dylan's song, Turn, 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 and they then popularized it with, the Birds then popularized it, you recall that. Maybe you don't recall that. Gee, that's scary, isn't it? Well, I still remember what was cutting edge as if it were yesterday. I'm afraid the Birds are not cutting edge. But after talking about a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to, for example, love, and a time to hate, a time for war, a time for peace, and all these, he then says, what profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I've seen the task which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. And here's the key verse. It's 3:11. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. We cannot see the whole picture, but here's the thing I want to leave you with. You have been hardwired by God to have eternity in your heart, and you cannot eradicate that longing for eternity. We may try to suppress it, but you can never eradicate it. You have that in yourself that will not be satisfied by this present world, by this present darkness. Admit that, and then realize that God is using this time, this earthly sojourn, to prepare you for your eternal citizenship in heaven.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.